This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Today's episode is part of a series of talks we recorded at the Beavertown Brewery Extravaganza, a massive 8,000-person anniversary party held over a couple of days in London, celebrating Beavertown Brewery. The folks from Beavertown invited Good Beer Hunting to host the symposium portion of the event. Knowing there were a number of leading voices in the industry that would be present in the same place, we took advantage to hash out some important ideas about the future of beer, both in the UK, the US, and around the world. These talks were hosted by myself and our UK editor, Matthew Curtis. This episode is hosted by Matthew Curtis. The topic is the modern beer portfolio, balancing a core range versus consumer demand for special releases. Our guest speakers are going to be Cosmo Sutherland from Beavertown Brewery, Evan O'Riordan from The Kernel, and Darren Anley from Siren Craft Brew. Listen in.
Excellent. Hi there, guys. Welcome to the first part of the seminars of the Good Beer Hunting and Beavertown Symposium. This is about the modern beer portfolio. We're going to discuss whether breweries should be investing in a core range of brands, or should they be chasing one-off releases? Should they be chasing hype? Or should they be doing their own thing? And I'm joined by a fantastic panel of people in the UK beer industry. So we have Darren Anley, who is the director and owner of Siren Craft Brew. We've got the owner and founder of The Kernel, Evan O'Riordan. And we have the lead brewer at Beavertown, who are putting on this rather amazing festival, Cosmo Sutherland. Can you put your hands together for these guys and thank them for joining us? Okay, so what is the modern beer portfolio? Years ago, brands could put stock in just having a single bitter or a lager, and because customers were so dedicated to a brand, brands didn't have to diversify. Then craft beer happened, and people started brewing so many different styles, and now it's about piquing interest, and as you know, the hazy double IPA, it's pretty popular at the moment. But so are a number of other styles, such as modern lagers, such as imperial stouts. And how do you find that balance between keeping something regular, a six-pack beer, in people's fridges, while keeping them excited in your brand? So first, Darren, I'm going to throw this over to you. At Siren, you have a pretty solid core range of beers. You've got a range of bottles. You do keg beer, you do cask beer, in a solid core range. You just added a new beer to that as well, which I want to talk about later. But you also do a myriad of special stuff. How do you find a balance between keeping that core range right and doing just the right amount of specials?
Yeah, I think it's always a challenge, to be honest, you know, trying to get that balance with making enough core. One of the things that we've always tried to make sure that we do with our core beers is to make sure that it's actually always in stock, so that a customer knows if they're going to put that on their bar and it's a permanent line for them, that it's always going to be available for them. So once you then start getting, you know, a big array of customers coming in and doing that, it kind of fills up your brew schedule pretty quickly. So it is always a challenge trying to get that. But yeah, the stuff that we like doing, the stuff that we enjoy playing around with, that's kind of what we, you know, what we wake up for. So we've got to make the time in there for it.
And in terms of the amount of time you spend brewing and your output, how much is split between your core range and your specials?
At the moment, we're probably about 70% cores and 30% specials. So if you keep, we've got a couple of other bits and pieces, things like Pompel Marcello and a few other things that are kind of, they're not specials, but we brew them as and when we feel like it. If you take that out, it's about 70%.
Fantastic. Cosmo, here at Beavertown, Beavertown in Tottenham, I feel like I'm at the brewery because there's so much. So it feels like we're at Beavertown.
Beavertown branding everywhere.
So you've got two breweries. You've got a big production brewery, and you've got the Tempest brewery for your specials. What advantages do you think that gives you? What flexibility do you get?
It gives us a huge amount of flexibility. So quite different to Siren, it seems. Our core range takes up the huge majority of our production. I think about 94% of what we do is core range, so that's five beers. And I think 84% of production is two beers. So like, we are doing a pretty narrow range of beer most of the time, and that's all coming out the big kit. But having the small kit, the pilot kit, which is 800 liter batches and the Tempest program, means we can get out more interesting stuff as and when we feel like it to an extent, whilst continuing to satisfy all those customers who have our beers on permanent lines and things and who need to have X many kegs of Gamma Ray delivered every week. So it's a huge bonus, and it was only something we actually got up and running about maybe a year ago again, after about a year or so of it being out of action as we expanded, had to install more tanks, move things around. It was just completely decommissioned in the corner of the brewery, gathering dust, which was a difficult time for us, and it's because of having that reinstalled that we can now actually put out more interesting stuff with slight more frequency than we used to.
Fantastic. And Evan, I think the best question to ask you is, how do you decide what to brew? And could you describe to the crowd how you see your beers? Do you have a core range, or do you literally just brew what you feel like?
I mean, you sent through questions for this a couple of weeks ago. I still have no idea what I'm going to say. I think we don't really approach beer with the terminology like portfolio or things like that in mind. But I mean, that doesn't mean that it doesn't fit into a portfolio. You know, it just means that that's not how we approach it. So, I mean, there are many days I wake up thinking there are only three types of beer anyway. There's pale beer, dark beer, and sour beer.
Yeah.
And that encompasses all we make. So yes, that's, you know, it all fits. Now, how you break those differences up kind of depends on where you want to chop definitions into smaller subsections or whatever. But we don't do much that's not already something that we always do regularly and repeatedly. So in that sense, it's a core range every single time. However, that core range is going to change every single time. So, yeah, the essence is core. So for us, a pale and hoppy beer has a certain signature and a certain way of doing things that we enjoy, certain flavors that we like. But each iteration will be its own specific iteration. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, fantastic. So Darren, you added a new core beer to your range, which is your Yulu Tea Leaf Pale Ale.
Yep.
What's the process? How did that start, and how did that go from being, it started as a one-off special, and how did that go from being a one-off special to being part of your core range?
Yeah, okay. So our core range for us, it covers quite a wide range. You know, we've got six different beers now as part of our core range. And the purpose of the core range for me, that I have for it, for our customers is, you know, we're preaching to the converted here. There's, you know, whatever it is, 4,000 people here today and tomorrow. You know, we know beer and we like beer and we like all the different things it can be. But there's still a world of people out there that, you know, haven't come into this world that we have. So for me, our core beer is that's its purpose. And you know, so while we kick off with a 4.5% oatmeal pale ale going up to 6.5% breakfast stout was where we were. We felt there was just a little bit of room at something a little bit lighter. So you know, we've been brewing Yulu as originally it was I forgot what it's called now.
Was it called White Tips?
No, it was
Boston Tea Party.
Yeah, Vermont Tea Party. That was the year before, and then Love of Work before that. So, the original idea was my brewer went over to Hill Farmstead and brewed a beer over there, and we then brewed kind of the same iteration over in our place. Then the next year we tweaked it a little bit, and then with Yulu we just tweaked it a little bit more and made it a permanent beer. And we just felt that, you know, it had a really good position in our range, you know, a little bit low alcohol. Something bright and spritzy. You know, I think everything that we've got in our range, you know, has something of it with a little bit of difference, a little bit of edge. And you know, having a 3.6% pale ale with lemon zest and tea kind of, again, just, you know, gives it that bit of edge, something a little bit different that kind of hopefully pulls people into what we do.
That's great. And Evan, when you're brewing at the Kernel, what's the thought process in terms of when you're going to brew a pale, when you're going to brew an imperial stout? How? Because I know you have, from what I know, everyone at the Kernel gets to dip their hand into brewing, and everyone does everything. You all help each other out. But at what point do you go, okay, this week we're going to brew some pale, this week we're going to brew some imperial stout, this week we're going to brew a beer that's going to go into a fooder for months or years? How do you decide at which point that beer is going to brew?
Those questions are straightforward enough in the sense that, you know, demand dictates to a large degree what we need to make. Most of the time, demand correlates with what we enjoy.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the nice thing about being a brewer, you hope, is that you get to make the beers that you want to drink. And quite a lot of our production reflects our drinking habits. So, you know, we might only make a percent or two of Imperial Brown Stout, but that, you know, we might only drink that 1% of the time. imperial brown stouts, export stouts, porters. I mean, we love our dark beers, but they don't sell half as fast as pale and hoppy things. So, yeah, the demand simply just dictates to us what we need to make within reason, and we have the ability to, you know, shift certain things if we don't like the way it's going. We've been actively making more table beer because it's 3%, and we think the world needs more of that. And we've been actively, therefore, making slightly less IPA because, well we have a pale or hoppy beer on the bar. Yeah, no. Well, it's just, that's our taste. And maybe, you know.
Yeah.
That's just what suits our.
We find, exactly the same thing with our dark beers. We had 3 dark beers in our core range at one point, but that's too many for a core range. So our Holy Cow became a winter seasonal. So, because we couldn't, there wasn't the demand to have 3 beers available at any one time.
Yeah. Speaking of seasonal beers, one of your most popular beers, your Bloody Hell IPA, the demand for that is huge. So what's the thought between, I know there's a seasonal thing with blood oranges, but you could technically get blood oranges from elsewhere in the world if you didn't mind racking up the air miles, which isn't a good thing. But why wouldn't you brew a beer like Bloody Hell year round?
It'd be a tricky one to fit in production at the moment. So one of our major problems with fitting in other beers around our core range is the amount of demand there is for the core range. We're doing 17 brews a week on average, and about 16 of them need to be gamma ray in their coil.
Yeah.
If they're not, we get angry customers and upset people.
Yeah. Has the popularity of gamma and neck oil, has that put strains on the rest of, obviously, because you can brew your one-offs in the Tempest project now, what kind of strain does gamma and neck oil put on Beavertown? Just meeting that demand.
Well, it's a lot of work, but at the same time, it's a great problem to have, having too much demand, that like more demand than you can supply. Like, it's the best kind of problem to have, really.
Yeah.
And the good thing about that is we don't need to spend too much of time trying to plan out recipes or anything, because we know exactly what we're doing with each beer. And I mean, I could probably brew it in my sleep, because I've done it so many times. And at the same time, it also allows you to work on other skills, which is like consistency and trying to get the same product out each time. Because in the day, like, beer making is a batch process. Like, every batch of gamma ray will be different, no matter what you want to do, because you'll have slightly different hops, slightly different malt. It'll be a bit hotter that day. The brewer will be hungover. There'll be something that'll lead to like it being a slightly different batch of beer. But being able to like try and keep it within as tight a spec as possible each time is like really good challenge to have, and that's why we've got a lab within the brewery, and you know, staffed by 2 full-time people purely, so we know exactly what our IBUs are each time, exactly what ABV is, exactly what the colour is, and we can work on it as we go along. But at the same time, to go back to the original question about whether it's a strain or not, at the end of the day, having beers which are so popular, which we can just knock out each time, that is like the bread and butter. It's like it funds everything else. So that means for some of our specials, we can do really stupid things, like where we actually lose money on the beer because we're putting an like obscene amount of something really expensive, like yuzu, when we're not gonna make any money on that beer, but it'll taste great and it's fine because we're making money on the other beers, which is 90% of what we do.
Yeah. So you've all invested heavily in barrel aging programs. In terms of mixed fermentation, there's stuff that takes a lot of time. So how do you balance putting time into beers that take 2 or 3 weeks to make into beers that take 1, 2, maybe 3 years to make? And this is a question to all of you. I don't know if you want to start, Darren, but like how does investing time in a barrel program affect concentrating on your core range of beers?
I think probably for us it's a different situation for you guys. We've got slots that we can make slots reasonably easily outside of our core range. So it's not it's not a difficult thing for us to do. The difficult thing to do is space and cash flow those are the issues with all those kind of things. You know, barrels take up a lot of space. You need to make sure you've got enough space between them so you can taste them and sample them regularly. And,
yeah.
If it
costs so much time and space, and it's difficult to do, but you're all doing it, so why? You know, why is it such an important part of what you do? And could you see it as part of your core range in a way, because you're just putting so much time into it?
Yeah, I mean, it can be a part of our core range because we just physically couldn't make enough to make it something that's going to be always available. We do it for the same reason we make all of the specials, because that's the fun side of what we do. It's that's the part where you get to express yourself You get to challenge yourself. So that's why we do it. And you know, part of what we do, we're very, very lucky in that we're in a business that people are buying our beers, they want to buy our beers, and they also really, you know, really dig on the fun stuff we do. So yeah, so it's just kind of an extension of that, really.
And Evan, you've probably got the smallest brewery out of the three of you here. How do you balance putting time into doing mixed fermentation stuff, stuff that's taking a lot of time on a small kit with a small space?
It's necessary. Have to do it. I mean, yeah, we have a lot of wood. We do a lot of mixed fermentation. And now we've got to the point where we have those available all the time. So they are, in a sense, now part of our, as you say, core range. Just like all our other cores, they're going to change all the time. We have different bits of wood. We'll treat them differently. We'll add fruit to some, and they'll come out as a, you know, a fruited beer. But the base beer that goes into them is pretty much, it's what we call our bière de saison. It's one, in essence, one beer with many different expressions. And yeah, we don't question its place in what we do. I mean, I think you're going to have a talk later on about terroir or about sour beers in general.
And both, in fact.
Yeah. And for us and anybody, I think, who's using mixed fermentation and barrel aging stuff, it's, you know, we have great love and pride in what we do, making, say, pale and hoppy beers and getting them to be exactly what you want. And when you take a barrel and take time and take bugs and put them in one, you know, one space and let them do their magic, you kind of follow them. You don't tell them what to do. So your relationship with what you do becomes kind of inverted, and you have to learn how to listen and smell and taste in a different way. It's not, a lot of pale hoppy stuff is you know, doing things properly. And you can do things completely wrong with the barrels and things like that and still get wonderful results. So you have to learn how to react in a different way. And I think for us, you know, as brewers, in relating to our environment and our world, that's its importance.
Would you rather be investing all of your time into making beers like that, or would you still love to invest a lot of time in your pale and hoppy beers as well that you can produce quickly, or just both?
Yeah, well, I don't, you know, I mean, when you have a brewery, you're in a lucky position of being able to a certain degree to pick and choose what's important to you, and you know, we don't have to separate, you know, I don't have to choose. It's quite nice to have both.
And Cosmo, you're at a bit of an advantage, but what's it like for a brewer that's, you know, you're a lead brewer on the production facility? Do you ever want to get over there into the Tempest facility and just, you know, kick Johnny out and say, well, I'm going to make something today? What's the feeling in the production brewery looking at Tempest going, when am I going to get a chance?
Well, we actually all get involved to a degree. So, yeah, Johnny, he's one of our senior brewers. He runs a Tempest program, and he's been doing it he took it from Tiago, who was running it for a year before or so. And yeah, he's doing a great job. He's putting out some really interesting beers. But it is a lot of work for one person. Even if it's just a small brew kit, we've still got 300 barrels over there with all sorts of different projects in them. We've got a pair of fooders and we've got, yeah, some stainless tanks as well. So there's a lot that needs to happen on a day-to-day basis. So yeah, we take it in turns to go over. Would I like to spend more time over there? Yeah, maybe it'd be fun and interesting. You get to learn a lot. Like, there's so much you can learn just even about how to manage barrels in terms of like racking and emptying and maintenance, things like that. It's almost fascinating. But the same can be said of like clean brewing as well. There's countless things you can learn on either side. So yeah, I'm not too jealous.
Brilliant. That's good to hear because we love Gamma and Neck Oil and we wouldn't want Tempest to impact on that. So what happens when you have a core beer that's tired? I'll ask this one more question and I'll open it to you guys if you've got any questions. I hope you have. So I'll ask this to all of you. What happens, I mean, Cosmo, we'll start with you. You dropped one of your stouts because you had too many stouts in your range, but like, what's the thought process in there and how do you think that impacts what you're doing and the image of Beavertown if you're having to drop a beer?
It can be a bit sad in one hand because every beer has its fans and no matter what beer we do, even if it's a special, we'll have people always ask us, when are you doing that beer again? Why aren't you doing it again? But at the same time, we have priorities and we have to look after our customers. I mean, these are people who have put their faith in us from the start and they take our beer and they still want to take our beer. So if they need X amount of gamma rate each week, we'll do our best to produce that. So if we got a beer sitting in the warehouse that's getting old and losing the character that it should have when it's drunk fresh and we want it to have. So, I mean, this was a stout, was a dry hop stout, so we wanted to be drunk, you know, within a few months, not sitting there for a year, then it doesn't really there's no point brewing it that frequently. So in the case of Cabo, yeah, we moved it to a winter seasonal. So it's not completely gone, but we just moved it to a portion of the year where its sales were the strongest anyway. People tend to prefer dark beers at that time of year. So we just focus on producing it then, and that should be enough to keep people happy.
And Darren, have you ever had to drop a core beer? And what's the thought process behind that, if you had to? And how did it make you feel?
We haven't actually done it. We start off with 4 core beers, and we've added 2 to it. It's an interesting question, and we have one product in our range, which we do question whether it's getting to that point, whether it's tired, whether it needs a bit of a kick. And to being honest, I don't know where I don't know how we move forward with that. So whether it's you give it a bit of a refresh, kind of change the recipe a little bit, or
make it hazy.
or whether you actually just completely drop it and do something completely and find a new recipe entirely, change the name and everything. So yeah, I don't know because we haven't done it, but I'll be interested to get everybody else's opinions on it.
Great. And Evan, have you ever had to drop a beer, and what was the thought process? Have you ever brewed a beer that you've just gone, no, we're never going to do that again? I'm sure you have.
Every brewer's done that many times. I mean, there's some evolutions on beers that we make. So if we always make something that we've always made pale ales, and you'll have a little offshoot that might be like an amber ale, for example. We've tried that.
Great.
That's not to our taste. Doesn't happen again. But you don't want to stop the possibility of that evolving into something that is interesting. But at the same time, if you recognize that that doesn't work for you or whatever, then that's fine too. Darren referred to a few beers that kind of pop up whenever the schedule allows or whenever you feel like brewing one again. And there's a couple of beers like that that we still bring back, and there's a couple that, I don't know, either for whatever reason don't happen anymore. We haven't brewed a double IPA for a couple of years. And most of that is technical.
You're probably the only brewer at the moment.
Yeah, but it's because we bottle condition and keg condition still, and that's an important part of who we are and what we enjoy about the flavors of our own beers. And I think we came to the point of realizing that having all that extra yeast and second fermentation in a double IPA just did not make sense. It doesn't suit.
That's great. Thank you, guys. And just give these guys a round of applause, because I thought that was fascinating. Okay, we are going to open up a Q&A. Please raise your hand, and we've got our fantastic runners either side of you, our volunteers in their Technicolor t-shirts. So please, if you've got a question, raise your hand. And if we're running out of time, someone wave at me. We've got a gentleman down here.
So,
okay.
Hello. Yep. Is that right? You were talking about the... if you had a beer that was quite tired, and do you think it's realistic that if you had a beer that was quite tired and it was known by the consumer already, do you think it's realistic that you could actually change the recipe to actually make it still appealing, considering it would already have a reputation, or do you think you'd have to drop it, really?
I think that's the question, to be honest, isn't it? What do you do? I know Stone recently changed recipes on a couple of their core beers, obviously dropped a few as well, but changed the recipes. I'm not sure how that's working out for them. My gut feeling at the moment would be I would probably drop it entirely, because I just feel that you'll have that crossover. If you try and keep the name, but actually, I think no matter how you put it out to try and say, right, we've made some tweaks and made some improvements, I think it'll always have, it'll always be reverted to back as that beer. And I think, we never really touched on it today in this conversation, but I think, one of the challenges is everybody wants something new. All the bar managers, the general managers, they're just chasing the new thing. If they see something on a list all the time, it's not necessarily the first thing they will do. I mean, obviously that's not always the case, but first and foremost, attention goes to what's new. So, core beers have got their, for me, they've absolutely got their place, and they will always stay that way. But I think that is one of the challenges that the industry's facing.
And on that, with things becoming more tired, sometimes it can also be out with the brewer's control, where, because obviously we're using hops and malt and those are all year dependent, you might find your suppliers giving you a certain kind of hop and this year you're not happy with the quality at all, and you've got to try and figure out a way around that. So sometimes you start making tweaks based on the materials you have available because the beer's changing for the worse compared to what it used to be, and you have to make changes to keep it where you want it to be. So you might change your recipe to an extent, but with the original kind of flavor in mind, with the original style in mind.
Okay, I saw another hand raise over here.
Hi there, guys. Oh, sorry. I know quality control is obviously a big issue for all three of the breweries. When you have a core range, obviously you can make your beer to the same specification every time. I was just wondering how Kernel managed to keep a very high level of quality control with such an adaptable core range, and what experiences you've had with your current core ranges in terms of keeping the quality control at the level you guys have managed to achieve over the past few years.
That's a very good question. I wonder about that myself. I mean, in the most general terms, I mean, I think it's quite obvious. You know, we want to be consistent, but consistent in terms of quality, and that doesn't mean that the flavor has to be consistent. So across, you know, if we make 10 different pale ales, we would like the consistency and quality to be there across all of them, and it has to be. Otherwise, you know, you're letting people down. But they're going to taste quite different inherently. How do we moderate that? It's hard. I mean, just in terms of people disagreeing on terms of flavors, you know. If you have a certain parameters that you have to hit, you can usually all agree that those have to be hit, and then you can agree if it hit it or not. Whereas if you're aiming at, like, lots of different places, then you might think that that tastes quite nice, and I might think it's a bit average, and you might think it's pour it down the drain. And, you know, we can all have those responses even to things that are, in some ways, you know, within a small sphere of what we would like our pale ale to be. So we have lots of interesting conversations about it. But again, part of the reason that we do that is it keeps us fresh, you know, because we have to reinvestigate every single beer as if it's unique. We can't rely on what last week's beers taste like. So for us, that keeps us engaged with the process of brewing. And we like to think that that engagement is, you know, keeps our beer tasting good. That's the idea.
I've got a question from our Fervent Few community. So anyone who doesn't know what the Fervent Few is, are the people who subscribe to Good Beer Hunting via Patreon. And we're actually live streaming that for them at the moment with this little camera on stage. So I've got a question from William Kudruff. And he says, I think this is a good question for you, Darren. How do you balance crafting traditional UK styles with innovative new styles in your portfolio?
Ooh.
Because you brew some more traditional UK styles like British Pale Ale, you do a great range of cask beer, but you also do New England IPA and Tea Leaf Pale Ale. So how do you find the balance between traditional and modern?
I think, you know, we brew what we like, is what it comes down to. Obviously, we have a cause, you know, they have their place, and when outside of that, we then look at, what have we not done for a while? What's taking our interest at the moment? You know, what are we liking? What inspiration are we getting from various places? We don't really approach it in terms of trying to balance something that's modern or something traditional at all. We just kind of look at it and say, what are we interested in at the moment? And, you know, what's got our juices flowing?
Fantastic. We've got time for one more question. Yes, it's a lady just here.
Hi, I work for a small Norfolk brewery, and the main reason I came along is because we focus quite heavily on having a core range of beers and then do the odd specials. But for me, it's quite essential that a brewery understands the fundamentals of brewing, and you've touched upon this already. Do you feel like from the current market, where there's a constant demand for change, innovation, and new beers, that we are losing the kind of core essentials of how to brew a beer properly? And there are excuses building around that to get away from it. So we're talking about a core range compared to specials here. Is there justification for those specials to not be to a high enough standard because they are a one-off and they're a different style?
That's a big question.
I mean, I don't mind starting if that's all right. I could think we absolutely don't take specials with the view of that they can be
a. Not aimed at any of you guys personally.
Phew. No, I mean, for us, we tend to view our specials as, you know, one of kind of a number of ways. You know, one of our guys kind of views a lot of, some of the stuff we do is kind of our batshit mental range, you know, and that's the kind of stuff that's just way out there. And I think for us, there's always the danger that, you know, we might miss what we're, you know, what we're aiming for. But we don't ever want to put out, a substandard beer. On the odd occasion, we have kind of felt that for us, I mean, we did a coffee project quite recently, and for us as brewers, there was one beer in there that we felt a little bit disappointed, kind of missed the target that we were aiming for. It was actually everybody else's favorite beer, which kind of shows we don't know anything, I think. But, you know, it goes back to what you were saying. You know, everybody has different approaches. We put it out because it was still a very good beer. Just missed a couple of the kind of key things that we wanted for. So I think in answer to the question, if you're putting out a special, it's got to be worthy of the name that you've got. You know, if you can't just put a beer out there just to be on the new list for the week. You know, so we certainly take it very, very seriously. Anything we put out there that's a special has got to be worthy of our name. Otherwise, you know, it gets put down the drain. We have done on occasion. So
yeah, the thing about specials, I suppose, is if you've not done a beer before, you don't necessarily know how it's going to turn out. You can, you know, use the best of your knowledge and as much research as you can. You can speak to other brewers who've used that yeast strain or that hop or whatever and find out what kind of flavors they get out of it and aromas and things like that. But sometimes it'll ferment weirdly or whatever, and you end up with quite a different beer to what you set out to make. And if it's a good beer, great. If it's not, well, then that's that. You can figure out a way to fix it, or you can pour it down the drain, which we've done a few times as well, core range and non-core range. If it's not good enough, it just goes down the drain.
Great. Thank you very much for your questions, guys. Thank you to these guys for coming on and chatting to you. I hope that was educational for you. So thank you again, guys. Cheers.
Thanks for listening, folks. If you'd like to hear more from this series, there are nearly a dozen talks published on Good Beer Hunting right now, all about a half an hour in length. They also should download one at a time into your iTunes library. If you'd like to support GBH, please join our Fervent Few subscriber community at patreon.com/goodbeerhunting. And join us next year at the Beavertown Extravaganza. Dates for that are sure to be announced soon. We plan to make next year's symposium even bigger and better. Aim true, poor liberal folks. Have a great week.